broken, I would naively expect that this kind of wave should exist with no gap. And also because this rotation is broken, so this kind of wave should also exist, and I expect that to be gapless. But as I said, that's not the case. In the case of ferromagnet, there's only this mode of the gapless wave or magnon, but not the other way. So there's only one mode, even though the two symmetry is broken. And this dispersion relation being quadratic can be confirmed by experiment. So what you have to do is basically just to measure specific heat at low temperatures. And you see two contributions here. One is the contribution from phonon of the lattice, and that gives you T cubed. But the quadratic dispersion gives you T to 3/2 in the specific heat. And what this plot is showing is the plot of specific heat divided by T to the 3/2 as a function of T to the 3/2. So this contribution is a constant in this plot, and that's the contribution of the quadratic dispersion, while the phonon contribution is the straight line. So you have two contributions shown in this same plot. And this also gives you a lesson that when you go to the lowest temperature, you can basically forget about the phonon because this actually disappears much more quickly than the magnon contribution. So this is telling us that somehow the quadratic dispersion is more important at low temperatures than the linear dispersion, and that gives you some picture of later on based on the vibration of the coset space. So the ferromagnet used to be pretty much the only example known which seems to defy the Goldstone theorem, but there are now many more examples these days. One of them is spinner BEC. So this is the BEC of atoms with finite spin. And in when the BEC was first discovered, they used the magnetic trapping, so the spin degrees of freedom have been frozen. But my colleague in Berkeley, Dan Stamperkern, came up with a laser trapping to produce the atomic BEC, so the spin degrees of freedom are no longer frozen, so you can actually study its dynamics. And for spin 1 atoms, the symmetry group is actually SO3 cross U1, because the spin 1 means that you have three components. Each of them are individually non-relativistic Schrodinger field. So you have the three-component column vector to describe the spin 1 atoms. And there's an overall phase, the degree of freedom, for the total conservation of the number of atoms. So that's why the symmetry is actually SO3 cross U1. But this actually can acquire this weird form of expectation value. And it's rather difficult to see why this actually preserves SO2, but let me do that. So this is a complex field, so I can divide this into the real part and imaginary part. And SO3 is still acting from the left, but this U1 is now a rotation between two columns, so that's the SO2 now acting from the right. And once you have this expectation value, this is the real part, so I put it here. This is the imaginary part, I put it over here. Then you can clearly see that you can combine SO2 subgroup of rotation from the left and SO2 rotation from the right, that leaves this expectation value invariant. So that's how you can see that SO2 is unbroken by this expectation value. So the coset space then is SO3 cross U1 mod SO2. That turns out to be a RP3, so pretty much the same thing as three-dimensional sphere. So there are three generators are broken. So three generators here, one generator here, overall four generators. Unbroken symmetry is only one generator. So three generators are broken. So naively, we expect three gapless Goldstone bosons, but there are only two. There's one with a linear dispersion and another one with quadratic dispersion. And after a lot of begging, Dan actually measured this quadratic dispersion experimentally, which you can see in this plot. So there's definitely this degree of freedom with quadratic dispersion with no gap. So beyond the ferromagnet, there are actually quite a few examples these days people talked about where the naive application of Goldstone theorem seems to fail. So this one such paper by the Shovkofi, who gave a talk yesterday, if I understand correctly, talks about abnormal number of number Goldstone bosons, abnormal number Goldstone bosons. Both of them came from nuclear physics. This one is from condensed matter literature, abnormal number of number Goldstone modes. So there's something missing in our understanding. And Nambu himself wrote a paper in 2003 talking about anomalous properties. And after reviewing this basic argument, it says there are, however, exceptions to the above theorem. So something was missing, and that's where the work by Tomasz and also myself came in. General reason for what anomaly? I'm sorry.
Exactly what you were saying.
Okay.
That's the fact that the order parameter is also conserved. Yeah, that's extremely well understood and discussed in great detail in the internet literature.
I actually, maybe we can talk about it later,
yes,
because I present my understanding,
right,
and if that is the same as what is known.
I don't doubt you're contributing something very important, but it is not correct to say that the reason for this has not been discussed and understood in many different languages.
Okay, okay. Yeah. Okay, so please correct me afterwards. So the points I'm going to make is very simple, and they have been already, I believe, mentioned by Tomasz on the first day. So the main difference between the antiferromagnet and ferromagnet is actually the expectation value of spin in z direction. So here there's no expectation value, and here's definitely a finite expectation value of spin in z direction. And the main point here is to rewrite this expectation value as a commutator of Jx and Jy. And once I do this, this actually looks pretty similar to the canonical commutation relation between x and p, because commutator of two operators have a finite value. And the Jx was supposed to create a Goldstone boson by this rotation, and Jy was supposed to create another Goldstone boson from this rotation. But now what you see is that they are canonically conjugate to each other, namely that two operators together describe 1 degree of freedom, just like an X and P do to describe 1 degree of freedom of a single particle. So that's the main statement. So whenever you have this expectation value of some charge density, which can be written as a commutator of two generators, what could have been a Goldstone boson for each generator become canonically conjugate to each other, and therefore they are no longer independent degree of freedom, but together they describe 1 degree of freedom. So based on this understanding, you can write down the most general effective Lagrangian for Goldstone bosons. For the case of a Heisenberg model, that had been written down actually previously by other people, but nonetheless, this is the form. And what you see here is that what could be a Goldstone boson for Jx generator, that's Nx, and Jy generator, that's Ny, has this so-called Berry phase term, so that you can see Nx and Ny are conjugate, canonically conjugate to each other, and therefore they do not describe two independent modes, but rather describe only 1 degree of freedom together. So that's the effective Lagrangian, and that's how we justify this statement. So the general formula, once you actually go to a general group, is simply this. So you compute the commutator of all the generators in a given system, and evaluate the expectation values. And because it's a commutator, there's an anti-symmetric matrix. And so the rank of this matrix is always even. And the idea here is that once you have this non-zero commutator, the generators A and B give you canonically conjugate degrees of freedom, and therefore two of them together describe a one Goldstone mode. And so that leads to this prediction that for the each pair in this commutator, you have 1 degree of freedom. So twice as number of this combination gives you the number of broken generators, while there may be some remainder if you subtract this from all the number of broken generators. So these guys do not participate in the commutator. So each of the generator here, which we call type A, would describe one Goldstone degree of freedom, while those who participate in this commutator, a pair of them describe one degree of freedom. So that leads to this prediction. And this was conjectured by Tomasz and my collaborator Haruki Watanabe earlier, but we'd like to justify it from the general formalism. So anyway, that's the statement, and that's something that I'd like to justify in the rest of my talk. And those type D Goldstone bosons, which do participate in the commutator matrix here, generically give you quadratic dispersion, while those who don't participate in this commutator generically give you a linear dispersion. Again, that's something I'd like to justify from the point of view of effective Lagrangian. And this single formula applies to every example that have been discussed and we could find in the literature. So that's the kind of thing we'd like to talk about as a general framework for the Goldstone bosons. Mostly internal symmetries, but if I do have time left, I may say a few words about the space-time symmetries. So the disproof I'm going to give here will be strictly for internal symmetries, but there are applications I can do for the space-time symmetries if I have time, any time left at the end of the talk. Okay, so the, what we do is simply write the low-energy effective Lagrangian for the system, and just like what people are familiar with from the case of Lorentz invariant systems, we introduce these fields which map from space-time to the space of vacua, ground states, that's parameterized by this coset space, G mod H. So they are quote-unquote pion fields. And we write the Lagrangian as a function of the field and their derivatives. And we require that this Lagrangian or action is invariant under the full symmetry group G, not just the unbroken symmetry H. And we also expand this Lagrangian in powers of derivatives. And that's because we are interested in the behavior at low energy, long distances, or low temperature, and we typically keep only up to the second order derivatives, but in some cases we need higher order derivatives. And what is well known in the case of Lorentz invariant systems is the famous Lagrangian by Kallan, Coleman, and Vestermeer. So we have these derivatives of the pion fields, and the only thing you need to provide is the metric on this coset space, and then everything is done. And this is highly predictive. Not only that it gives you the spectrum of Goldstone bosons, but also gives you interaction among them, and that had been verified experimentally in the case of pions. So this is the general Lagrangian. And obviously, this Lagrangian also tells you that for each broken generator, you have one pion field which behaves like a free massless scalar particle if you switch off interactions. What happens when you throw away Lorentz invariance is that instead of just one term, you can write three terms. And these two terms look similar to the Lorentz invariant case. The only difference is that now time and space have to be treated separately. So you have metric for the term with spatial derivatives, but also another metric for the term with a time derivative. So that's the generalization here. But in addition, you can also have this term, which is the first order in time derivative. And this Lagrangian had originally been written by Leutwiler, but it's now much more general, as I will talk about now. So using this Lagrangian, you can easily identify the spectrum just by expanding these functions of the pion fields around the origin. So these two are familiar, so let's not talk about that now, and just focus on this one here, which is the new term, which had not been allowed in Lorentz invariant systems. So what you do is to expand this around the origin. So this is the constant term, first derivative, second derivative, and so on. And this constant term multiplying pi dot is a total derivative in Lagrangian so that you can throw that away. So that doesn't do anything. But this term, the first order in derivative, gives you a term linear in pi multiplied by pi dot. So it has the structure of pi pi dot, which is basically this the form of the Lagrangian written in phase space, pq dot. And that is the term that gives you this canonically conjugate structure. So if you restrict yourself to subspace among these pion fields where this matrix CAB is invertible, that gives you this canonical commutation relation. And so if you go to low energies, and once this term is present, this term is order energy because it's time derivative. This term is energy squared, so this term is less important at low energy than that term. So let me just ignore this term for the moment. And yes?
The pi is a coordinate on the coset.
Yes.
So how can you expand it around?
You can choose any point on a coset space because all points are equivalent on a coset space. So I just arbitrarily choose one point, in which I call origin.
But you break the G symmetry.
Yes.
You said that your Lagrangian should be invariant under the G.
That's right.
Right now you're releasing that.
No. So choosing an origin corresponds to choosing a particular ground state. So in the case of Heisenberg model.
So basically, this one is not, but the one you started with is invariant under G.
Yes. So Lagrangian is invariant. This Lagrangian is actually invariant. But choosing an origin breaks the symmetry spontaneously. And that's how you describe the space of all the ground states and the local fluctuations of it. Am I answering your question?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So if I ignore the second term here, then the first term dominates. And in this case, you can write down what a nodal current is for the symmetry. So that's the usual definition here. And that actually turns out to be proportional to pi field itself, because this derivative respect to pi dot picks up this one, which is now expanded by the CAB matrix. And this is just a shifting pion field away from the origin. So this is the nodal current. And using this commutation relation, I can compute their commutator. So the commutator between two charges is again given by this coefficient CAB. So that's the statement I made earlier, which was originally empirically found by Thomas and Haruki, that the commutator of two generators here, if this is non-zero, then that actually turns into this form, because this is the same thing. And once you have this, then you are supposed to have this term in the Lagrangian. And therefore, for each commutator matrix of this type, you are supposed to have this term in the Lagrangian, which gives you this canonically conjugate structure between the pion fields. Therefore, for each of this commutator, once the generator participates in this commutator, it is necessary that two generators work together to describe one degree of freedom of the Goldstone boson. In addition, we also learned something about the dispersion relation. So once you ignore this term goes like energy because it's first order and time derivative. This term goes like momentum squared because the second order and spatial derivative. And therefore, energy should go like p squared. And that's the quadratic dispersion, as we have seen in the case of Heisenberg model. But if the generator does not participate in this commutator, then the first term is missing. Then energy square should go like momentum squared, and that's the linear dispersion. So that's why, typically, those type B Goldstone bosons based on with non-zero commutator give you quadratic dispersion, while those who don't participate in the commutator will give you linear dispersion. But this is only typical situation because if I have time, I will give an example where this term actually happens to be forbidden by space-time symmetry, so that expansion starts with a fourth order in derivative. So even when you don't have this term, namely for type A Goldstone bosons that don't participate in this commutator matrix, if you have this term here, that's energy squared, and momentum to the fourth term balancing against each other, you do find quadratic dispersion, even when they don't participate in the commutator matrix. So there are exceptions. So that's why this dispersion relation is generically true, but not necessarily always true. But anyway, the main point is that if two generators participate in this matrix, then the corresponding pion fields are canonically conjugate to each other. So two of them together describe one degree of freedom. And so that's an example that appears in the Heisenberg model. So this is the summary of the what's going on here. So if a generator does not participate in this commutator expectation value, you find this type A Goldstone bosons. For each generator, there's a separate one degree of freedom. And typically, they have this linear dispersion. But if a generator participates in this commutator matrix, then two of them describe one degree of freedom. And typically, you find this quadratic dispersion instead. So this is actually a strange situation, namely that given one coset space G mod H, some of the coordinates are paired, and some others are not. So your coset space is a mixture of a phase space, which has P and Q, and configuration space living inside the same manifold. So the phase space and configuration space are mixed up in a space of ground states. And that's a rather unusual structure I haven't seen before. So it turned out in mathematical literature, such as a structure is called presymplectic structure, and that actually helped us understand how one can actually classify what terms are possible here for a given choice of the symmetry groups, as I will discuss in a few minutes. Yes?
This CA of zero term, it's not fully enough. It shifts the point in the meta space.
Right, that's right. For example, that is a chemical potential term in superfluid, for instance. So you can find a physical interpretation of that term. The reason I said I can throw it away is for the purpose of just identifying spectrum. and also discuss their interactions. For that purpose, they are innocuous, but certainly I agree that there could be a physical interpretation of that total derivative term. Okay, so what is the connection between this first term and actual physical observables? It turns out that that actually means a charge density of the ground state. So, first of all, this term here can, in principle, change by a total derivative. The action is invariant, but the Lagrangian density might change by a surface term. So that's something you can work out. And if you have the surface term, the definition neural current also picks up this surface term. And the first term depends on the time derivative. So if you take expectation value in the ground state, which is meant to be a stationary state, there's no time evolution, so I can drop this, that this is the term that actually gives you the density of this neural current. So the existence of this term, it has to do with the expectation value of the charge density for a given symmetry. So that's the connection to the physics side, how or what this term actually means. On the other hand, from the point of view of geometry, so the reason why this understanding of Goldstone boson has been so successful, at least in Lorentz invariant case, is that the only data you need to provide is the metric on the coset space. Everything specified is very highly predictive, and there's a geometrical understanding for it. So we would like to come up with also a geometrical understanding of the first term as well. And what this term is doing is, first of all, this can be regarded as a one form on the coset space, because if you do the time integral, I can strike off dt here, and that gives you d pi, so that's the one form on the coset space. And as I said, this may be changed by a surface term under symmetry transformation. So if you do an infinitesimal transformation, it may be a total derivative. But what that means is that if I define a two form, which is the derivative of this one form, that has to be invariant. Namely that this coset space not only has a metric, but has an additional structure of this group invariant two form, which is a closed two form. And this basically describes this canonical conjugate structure between P and Q. But this two form may be degenerate. As I said, the coset space may be only partially phase space. Some coordinates are paired in the canonically conjugate pairs of P and Q, but some others don't. So this two form is, in general, degenerate. It doesn't have the full rank. And so that is the situation. It's called the presymplectic structure. Anyway. Once you identify the Lagrangian, you can do something useful with it already. So you can discuss the stability of the long-range order at the zero temperature. And so if you have only type A Goldstone bosons, I don't have the first term. So it starts with the second power in time derivative. And what I can do is to do the usual scaling arguments to see if a long-range order is stable, namely if the interaction in the system can be ignored at long distances. And in this case, the time and space derivatives comes with the same power, so I should scale them in the same way. Then this is the scaling for the pion field. Then you can see how interaction term like this one scales. So for dimension, spatial dimension d greater than 1, this damps at long distances. So that's why we expect the stable long-range order when dimension is 2 and above. But when the spatial dimension is 1, as is well known, the symmetry may be restored at long distances by Coleman's theorem or Merman-Wagner's theorem at finite temperature. On the other hand, when you have the first derivative in time here instead of second power in time derivative, space and time need to be scaled with different power. And then you can again ask the question if an interaction term would be relevant or irrelevant at long distances. So in this case, you find even in one spatial dimension, this damps at long distances. So the long-range order is actually stable. And so the system becomes IL-free for actually any spatial dimensions 1 and above. So to me, it was at least puzzling why a ferromagnetic chain would break a symmetry even when the space-time dimension is only 1 plus 1. But this can be seen simply from the scaling argument once you know what the Lagrangian is. What's that?
Interaction corrected often just zero.
Right, right.
Because the loops are just zero.
Right, right. So that's another way of saying the same thing. But yeah. No, no, interaction term is present though.
No, but all the loop corrections are zero.
Yes, the loop corrections are zero. That's right, yeah.
How do you do the scaling argument? There are both types of loops. There are both types A and B. What's the proper way to do it?
Then I don't know the proper way of doing it. So then you probably have to study each system one by one and really look into the loop corrections and find out what's going on. Following the same path people have done in the case of Lorentz invariant systems, you can come up with explicit forms of these terms using the so-called the Kalankormov-Vizsumino construction. So the pion fields are meant to be exponentiated to represent the symmetry transformations of the group, and they transform in this highly nonlinear way. But once you actually build something, these so-called Morey-Cauchon forms in terms of these pion fields, you can explicitly write down the form for the metric in terms of what you have only at the origin. So whatever you specify at the origin would generalize for the entire manifold because everything is related by symmetry. So that's an explicit expression for this. And also for the term I mentioned earlier about this charge density, once you know this density of the charge operator in the ground state, you can write this general form for this first term, again, just by contracting with the Morey-Cauchon form. So everything is very, very explicit. So the only thing you need to specify to come up with this Lagrangian is to provide the metric at the origin and this charge density in the ground state. Then everything else is specified. And you can also predict all interactions and property of topological defects and so on. And we'll come back to the defects later on.
How unique is this choice for the metric? Is there a unique invariant metric or not?
If the pions are irreducible representation of the unbroken group, then this is just specified by the invariance of that unbroken group. So this is just an overall normalization. This one?
Yeah.
So this also is important auto parameter, namely that the charge density. So once you specify it, then this basically belongs to an adjoint representation of the group. Uh-huh. And just by multiplying with this Morey-Cauchon form, this is now extended to the entire G mod H.
Yeah, I'm asking if it's also easily determined, if the pions are in the reducible representation, is it determined uniquely?
It's not unique, but you can classify it.
Okay.
So the question here is that once you have specified what group you're talking about, G and H,
yeah,
what kind of terms you can write down here,
yeah,
and that can be classified, and I tell you how it can be classified. So for a same symmetry breaking pattern of G and H, there are other possibilities depending on what EK you introduce, and you can mathematically classify what the possibilities are. And the everything has a simple geometrical foundation, thanks to this theorem by Chu. So under some condition, if the second dimensional cohomology group of the D algebra vanishes, which is the same thing as saying if there is no central extension, then every closed two form on G gives you a symplectic homogeneous space. And what that means is that you can have this simple structure of vibration. So here's the coset space. And this coset space is a mixture of the phase space and configuration space. And you can always find this projection down to a base manifold, which is purely phase space. So all the coordinates are now paired on it. So you can project this down to a space with only the paired, namely type B Goldstone bosons, which sort of makes sense, as in the case of the specific heat we looked at before, namely at a zero temperature limit. You can ignore linear dispersion, and you can focus on quadratic dispersion. So this projection makes physically intuitive sense. And once you do so, on this base manifold, all coordinates are paired, where the coefficient of this pairing is given in terms of the commutator of the generators, as we discussed already. And this base manifold has this now symplectic two form. So you can pull it back to the coset space by this projection. And that defines this closed G invariant two form on the coset space. Now, the coordinates that are projected out in this projection do not participate in this by definition. So those coordinates now describe the type A Gostom bosons, typically with a linear dispersion, while the coordinates living on the space manifold are all paired, and they are the type B Gostom bosons, typically with the quadratic dispersion. So so those who are paired describe 1 degree of freedom based on the pair of generators, and again, come back to this original prediction. So so this way, you can do a precise counting of degrees of freedom and write down the effective Lagrangian for any choice of G and H, and I will tell you how that can be classified. And this projection can be proven to be possible for any compact semi-simple groups. But if this group is not semi-simple, namely that if it has U1s and so on, there are actually an exception to this rule, namely that you can have a central extension. So as I said, this term may change by a total derivative term, and which is related to this charge density. And if you look at the transformation property of this one here, it does transform as an adjoint representation as you would expect. But if I try to get rid of derivative from both sides of this equation, there may be an integration constant in general. So this constant is antisymmetric between two generators. And this kind of thing is not possible for semi-simple group, but possible if we have multiple U1s. So U1s, you think that they would all commute with each other, but it turns out once you have this integration constant, two U1s may not commute with each other, and they have the so-called central extension, and I'll give you some example of that in a moment. And this is indeed the case what happens when you apply a magnetic field, and so there are actually real-world examples where this central extension happens. Okay, so having understood the basic structure of the theory, we can systematically go up from the case with only one broken generator to two and three and so on, and see what kind of examples would show up in each case. So if we have only one broken generator, namely that if we have only one pion field, certainly there's no way of coming up with a pairing of the commutators. So you don't have the first term. So the only thing you should consider are these two terms. And the metric is also trivial for one-dimensional case. So you have time derivative squared and the spatial derivative squared. And what's different from the Lorentz invariant case, of course, is the metric can be different from each other. So that gives you a speed of sound instead of speed of light. And so this is basically the Lagrangian for, let's say, a phonon, 1 degree of freedom. And that's the only thing you can write for the case of broken U1. So that's how the Gostom theorem looks like it's applicable even without Lorentz invariance, even though the system is intrinsically non-Lorentz invariant. But once you get up to two pions, the things can change dramatically. So for two pion fields, one possibility is their coset space is two-dimensional sphere, and that's already the case of the magnet. And the two-dimensional sphere is actually symplectic, so you can actually use the volume form on this two-dimensional sphere. So this is a unique volume form up to normalization on S2, and you force yourself to write this as a total derivative of something else. And then this something else is the one form you stick back into this Lagrangian. So this unique term you can write up to normalization for the first term in effective Lagrangian. And it can be written in two different ways. I'm going to use both expressions. But nonetheless, if I take this form, I just stick this back into Lagrangian, and that fixes this first term in the Lagrangian up to an oval normalization, which corresponds to the oval magnetization vector. And also the metric is unique up to an oval normalization, so that it actually gives you this term. So this Lagrangian is totally unique up to just two constants. And clearly, this gives you 1 degree of freedom because these two coordinates are canonically conjugate to each other, and energy goes like momentum squared, hence the quadratic dispersion. But even on S2, you can choose not to put the first term in, and then you find antiferromagnet. So if you don't put the first term in, you have to start with the second power in time derivative that gives you this term instead, and then you have two independent Gostons for two different coordinates on S2, two-dimensional sphere, and they come with the linear dispersion because energy squared goes like momentum squared. So that already gives you an illustration that even for the simplest case you can imagine, just a two-dimensional sphere, you can have two different kinds of theories depending on if you put this term in or not. And if you don't, that corresponds to the case with no charge density. So that's clearly in accordance with what we know for antiferromagnet. But the case with this term, you have this charge density, and that also is consistent with this idea that all the spins are lined up. So that's the way you can systematically classify all possibilities for a given coset space. Even for the flat plane as a coset space, then you can write the two form on it, and you can force yourself to again write it in terms of the total derivative of one form. You put that in here. Then what you find is that this is a Lagrangian for non-relativistic free particle. So you can regard non-relativistic free particle as a Goldstone boson of a symmetry of shifting the field in a complex plane. And so in this case, the shifting this field in x direction or y direction, you would think that they would commute with each other. But what you find from this, the first term in the Lagrangian, is that shifting in two directions are actually canonically conjugate to each other, and therefore they don't commute. So that's the simplest example of the central extension I mentioned earlier. And this is possible because shifting the field is not a semi-simple group, and therefore you can have a central extension. But again, you can decide not to put this term in, and then you start with the second power in time derivative. So this is simply, let's say, a phonon in two-dimensional lattice. And once you go up to the three coordinates, so the example I mentioned earlier already is this the three-dimensional sphere, or rather modified Z2, but that doesn't actually change things very much. And then you can find, again, a projection of three-dimensional sphere down to a two-dimensional sphere. That is the Hopf map. And on two-dimensional sphere, you can have this pairing of coordinates because it's symplectic. You can pull it back to the three-dimensional sphere of the symplectic form on the two-dimensional sphere using this projection. And that defines the canonical structure between two of the coordinates on three-dimensional sphere. And one coordinate is left alone. So the paired coordinate of two of them gives you one type B Goldstone with a quadratic dispersion, as I have shown you data of. And another leftover coordinate gives you type A Goldstone boson because it's not paired and gives you linear dispersion. So even though you have three broken symmetries, you have only two Goldstone bosons, one type A and type B. So that's the example I discussed at the beginning. And now you can understand why that actually comes out to be the case. But on the same three-dimensional sphere, again, you can decide not to put this first term or two form. In that case, you can find also a structure which gives you this coset space. And in this case, because you don't put this term in, you find three Goldstone bosons for three broken generators. All of them have linear dispersion. And this mode is also realized in cold atom systems called the polar phase of the spinner BEC. So you can have all of these examples depending on a given coset space and what kind of pairing you introduce among the coordinates on the coset space. But you cannot arbitrarily choose any pairing you want because it's restricted by the group theory. For example, if you take this coset space, then you have six broken generators and six coordinates. And you may think that you can actually introduce any number of pairs among these six coordinates, but it turns out that this possibility doesn't exist. So for a given coset space, you can systematically classify what are the possible pairing among these coordinates, and that actually becomes a little mathematical, but nonetheless you can do it. And you can also classify the central extensions as well. So that goes back to an old theorem by Borel. So if you actually find an abelian group inside a symmetry group and talk about all possible generators that actually commute with that abelian subgroup. So this abelian subgroup describes the charge density, the expectation value of the charge on the ground state, and that generates an abelian subgroup. And whatever that commutes with it, the coset space turns out to be symplectic. So that way you can find all possible symplectic structures for a given expectation value of the charge operator. And also you can classify what other pairings are possible among U1s. It's just picking two out of the K U1 generators. And so I don't go through this, but I can, for example, show you a table of all possible this pairing structure or pre-symplectic structure on a given coset space. So this is a list of all possible rank 5 groups. And for SU6, SO10, SO11, and SB5. And so this is the complete set of possibilities. So you can systematically do that. And that way, you can reproduce this table of all possibilities in many different areas of physics. One thing I did not talk about, though, is that when you go to rather low dimensions, in addition to the three terms I mentioned already, there are possible other terms you can write. For example, this may look like a theta term in the case of antiferromagnet, for instance. In 2 plus 1 dimension, you can also write a term like this one for the spatial derivatives only. This is antisymmetric. There are more possibilities in lower dimensions, but nonetheless, again, you can completely classify what kind of terms you can write for a given coset space, given pre-symplectic structure in a particular dimension. And once you have the Lagrangian, you can start applying it, and this is something which I find very actually amusing. So once you have a 2 plus 1 dimensional system, and find a soliton in the Lagrangian I talked about already, you find that soliton has a peculiar behavior that there are two momenta in the x and y directions may not commute. And how much they do not commute actually turns out to be proportional to a topological number. So the simplest example is the skirmion. So again, going back to a Heisenberg ferromagnet, so the coset space is S2, as I mentioned already quite a few times. And if you have 2 plus 1 dimensional system, I have 2 dimensional plane, and 2 dimensional plane can wrap around the 2 dimensional sphere by integer times. So that's characterized by this the winding number. And the skirmion solution can be moved to any location on this 2 dimensional sphere. And then if you actually look at the quantum mechanics of this skirmion position, you find that their position or momenta do not commute with each other, and their commutator is given in terms of this winding number, it turns out. And I give you two derivations of the same result. One of them is brute force. You just start with this Lagrangian I used already, and I rewrite in using the polar coordinates, a theta and phi. And the first term here tells you that the phi is canonically conjugate to cosine theta. So you have this commutation relation. And definition of the momentum vector is given by that, again, just following the Noether procedure. And just go ahead and compute the commutator between x component and y component of this operator. So here's the commutation, a canonical commutation relation. This is a momentum operator. Here's the commutator between px and py. Then this phi and this cosine theta don't commute. This cosine theta and that phi don't commute. So that gives you this delta functions. And I do integration by parts, and I arrive at this expression. And the textbook tells you to forget this because this is a total derivative. But this total derivative is nothing but the winding number in this case, so you cannot ignore it. So that's how you can see that two momenta don't commute and give you the winding number of this skirmion solution. And another way of doing it is just sticking in a solution back into the Lagrangian and work it out, and you get exactly the same answer. And this has an amusing consequence, which can, in principle, be tested in experiment. So now that we have this non-commuting x and y, the Lagrangian actually looks like this. And if you push this skirmion solution in x direction, the same thing as applying a force in x direction. So this is a potential term that will give you a force in x direction. And if you just write down the Lowell Lagrange equation, you find this. So the force in x direction produces a motion in y direction. And that is what's known as Magnus force. If you actually push a skirmion this way, it always moves sideways. It's kind of peculiar. And this also happens for vortices in superfluid. And you can, again, go through the same kind of derivation and find that the px and py don't commute. And skirmions can now be produced in real experiments, like this one. This is the triangular lattice of skirmions. And what I will show you now is a computer simulation done by these people looking at the motion of skirmion in a potential well. And this really does show that if you push the skirmion one way, it moves sideways. First of all, so this simulation has to go through this interaction of many, many spins inside, so it's a pretty heavy numerical calculation. But when the skirmion moves in this direction and tries to hit this wall is trying to push it back this way, but it doesn't bounce back, it actually moves sideways. And it may be a little difficult to see. Let me show this a couple more times. When skirmion is pushed this way from this wall, it moves down. And it's pushed by this wall this way, it actually also moves sideways. So whenever a force is applied on a skirmion solution, because it's non-commuting momenta, against the force, it moves sideways. Against the force, it moves sideways. And that's the simple consequence of this rather amusing property.
So for the coordinates of the skirmion, they're also
non-commuting. That's right. So this is the collective coordinate of the skirmion. And Lagrangian actually turns out to be this. So x and y don't commute, nor px and py. And this is actually quite general. So if you consider any compact Cayley manifold as a target space of this effective Lagrangian, then by definition, the compact Cayley manifold has non-trivial two-cycle. So you can find a non-trivial mapping of the 2+1 dimensional system on this target manifold. And you can also show that the translations don't commute for this general setup either. So this is actually quite similar to something many particle physicists know from the Witten-Olive work, where the space-time symmetries, like supersymmetries, actually don't give you the usual anti-commutator, but is centrally extended by amount that's actually given by a topological number, like magnetic charge. So in this case, space-time symmetries of translation also have this central extension given by a topological number. So that's the one of the consequences. And how much time do I have left?
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Okay, then I just have a brief words about the space-time symmetries. So far, the only thing I discussed so far are internal symmetries. And when you have space-time symmetries that are spontaneously broken, it has been well known in the literature that, again, you have a smaller number of Coulomb bosons than number of broken generators. And so the dilaton is a famous example of it. And the way we understand and we want to understand it is by simply considering so-called the Noether constraints. So the reason why you have fewer number of Coulombs than number of broken generators is that in such cases, certain operators generating symmetries have a linear combination that annihilates the ground state. And once this happens, it's very obvious that once you actually try to look at this matrix element of each current operator producing a Goldstone boson, they are linearly dependent of each other, and therefore there's a redundancy, and so there are fewer independent degrees of freedom. And this is the way, at least I never understood this before, but why there is no Goldstone boson for rotational symmetry in a crystal. There is the Goldstone boson for translational symmetry, namely phonons in a crystal, but there is no the Goldstone boson for rotational symmetry. And the reason turned out to be very simple. So basically because L, that's the rotation, is given by X cross P, and local version is that the Noether current for the rotation is given by X cross energy momentum tensor for the momentum. So this Noether current is now linearly dependent on a Noether current of the translation, and no wonder why this doesn't produce an independent Goldstone boson's degree of freedom. So this is the way we can understand at least all examples I know when the space-time symmetries give you less Goldstone bosons than number of broken generators, and that happens because the symmetry generators are linearly dependent on each other. So one example one can study is the Galilean boost. So if you have the simple superfluid with this usual Ginzburg-Landau description, you have an expectation value of the Schrodinger field. And obviously, this breaks the U1 invariance, as we talked about before, giving you this linear dispersion for the phonon. But at the same time, this expectation value also breaks this Galilean boost. So this is also spontaneously broken. And because the boost can be done in all spatial directions, namely three of them, you actually have four broken symmetries, three Galilean boosts and one U1, but you have only one Goldstone boson for phonon. And again, in this case, it turns out to be very simple, namely that the neural current for this Galilean boost is given in terms of this combination, which includes this U1 current, it turns out. And that's why there is a linear dependencies between the U1 Goldstone and the boost Goldstone, and these Goldstone bosons are not independent from the phonon, from the U1. So again, you can understand what's going on just by looking at these operators. And most intricate example we have seen is the lattice of vortices that appeared in the previous talk. So let's say you have a BEC of a system, and let's say this is two-dimensional. You rotate the bucket, and you find this lattice of vortices arranged in a triangular lattice. So in this case, it's a superfluid, so obviously U1 is broken. But because it's lattice, translation in x and y directions are broken. And also rotation is broken too. So you have four broken symmetries in this system. But there's only one Goldstone boson. And given that there's only one Goldstone boson, it has to be type A, because there's no possible pairing with only one field. But it turns out that dispersion relation is quadratic. So that's why this is a kind of unusual example. That's why the general prediction that type A should be linear dispersion is not always true. So in this case, the way you understand there's only one Goldstone degree of freedom at the end of the day is, again, by looking at this relationship between operators. I already told you that the translation and rotation are related, so let's forget about those. And then ask the question how U1 operator and the translation are related. And it turns out that because you're rotating a bucket, you're in rotating frame, the amount of rotation you have to do is this omega. And then the energy momentum picks up the term proportional to this rotation in a way related to the U1 current. So this is another example here that the different symmetry generators are actually related at the operator level. So that's why the translation does not produce a different Goldstone boson from what is produced from the U1 current. And that's why you have only one degree of freedom at the end of the day. And you can write down the precise effective Lagrangian following this. And it turns out that the remaining Goldstone boson transforms in a way proportional to the distance from the origin under the U1 symmetry, because it picks up the term proportional to this rotation of the system. And because of the symmetry, which is space dependent now, you cannot write the usual derivative of theta squared, because that would not be invariant under this. The only place you can start will be derivative squared of this field squared to cancel this space-dependent the translation of the field. And that's how, even though there's only one field, you find E squared going like P to the fourth and gives you this quadratic dispersion relation. So this general the correspondence between the linear dispersion and type A Goldstone boson is not necessarily true if a symmetry property forbids the lower order derivative and if the expansion starts with the fourth order in derivative. And finally, one amusing example is when you actually look at some of the cases when you have also fractional dispersion relation. And then let me skip this slide. So in some cases, you would like to also integrate out some gapless excitation to look at a subsystem. So this is what is called Riplon. If you have one superfluid here, another superfluid down here, and this is the surface separating two superfluids. And the surface, of course, breaks the translational invariance. So its fluctuation would be the fluctuation of this boundary, and that actually is what is called Riplon. And it turns out that the spectrum actually is fractional in this case. So energy goes like the peak, the 3/2. And this can also be easily understood using effective Lagrangian, namely that if you try to describe the motion of this wall between the two superfluids, then you basically have to integrate out the phonon degrees of freedom in the bulk. And because you integrate out the gapless degree of freedom, then your effective Lagrangian becomes non-local. And that non-local Lagrangian then can represent this spectrum of the Riplon. And similar thing can also happen in the 2D Wigner crystal with, again, the fractional dispersion relation. So I'd like to conclude now then so that we can move to lunch. So the Goldstone boson is an age-old subject, but there seems to be still a lot to learn from them. And for internal symmetries, I hope I presented to you the precise counting rule of the Goldstone bosons and how they relate to dispersion relations on general grounds. And there's a simple geometrical understanding behind this effective Lagrangian, and you can systematically classify all possibilities. And it's an amusing consequence of this that the soliton may have this non-commuting coordinates, so that if you push it one way, the object moves sideways. And you can also study the case of the subsystems where dispersion relations can be fractional. And for space-time symmetries, often you find these redundancies so that you have even fewer number of Goldstone bosons than number of broken symmetries when you find these operator relations. And this subject is, I believe, Thomas discussed already. If you actually break the symmetry explicitly, some Goldstone states acquire a gap, which you can predict exactly based on the symmetry principles alone. And more recently, we also discussed how these systems can be gauged. But now, trying to finish up the story when the Dan Friedman informed Jeffrey Goldstone about the title of my talk, I realized that I have to go to MIT in person and give a talk in front of him and see how he will react to this. And at the end of the day, he became very happy, and he told me why. So this is his famous paper where he proved the theorem. But in his paper, he has the following remark. The present work merely considered models and has no direct physical applications. And apparently, he has been ridiculed about his theorem, namely that nature doesn't seem to use it. You know, at least in Lorentz invariant examples, the closest you can come up with the pion, but it's a pseudo Goldstone boson. It's not a true Goldstone boson. There's no massless scalar particle in nature. So apparently, he has been ridiculed that, well, this is a great theorem, but doesn't seem to have any place in Mother Nature. But he became happy after listening to my talk because with the generalization to non-Lorentz invariant case, he can now claim that all the examples I talked about are now according to his theorem. So there are tons of examples in Mother Nature which now follows this generalized Goldstone theorem. So that is the end of the story. Thank you for your attention. So now I'd like to take the criticism again.
I have a different criticism.
Okay, a different criticism.
In these theories where you have fractional dispersion, uh-huh. is there any sense in which the non-locality is controlled that you can't generate operators with different non-analyticities in the measure?
So in this case, what you do is really start from the Lagrangian with this bulk degrees of freedom at the beginning, and you integrate those out. So it's a well-defined procedure.
But then aren't you just really using the theory with all the Goldstone bosons, which don't have fractional dispersion?
Say that again?
I'm trying to understand, in what sense is there any useful effect of the theory where you have this non-analytical? I mean, I believe you that if you integrate out gapless things...
Right. Useful. Well, so in this case, you are not really interested in this the phonons in the bulk, and just trying to describe how this boundary what kind of dynamics this boundary has, right? So you are not interested in any part of the system, and that's why you integrate it out, not because they are gapped, but because you don't want to look at it.
But just because you don't want to look at it doesn't mean it's a good idea, right? In the sense that, you know, so it is the theory of just the Riplon is presumably not unitary either. Because it can share probability.
Yes. But by writing down this non-local effective Lagrangian, you can describe how this boundary can fluctuate. And for that purpose, it is useful.
But it might make sense if these impulses are much faster than we want. So then they produce kind of instantaneous interaction, but which doesn't have any current.
Yeah, like boom.
Does that come from a one-loop calculation that you and three had?
No, this is actually tree level.
Oh, they're not. So it is level.
Yeah,
it's a meeting.
Oh. So in this case, is sound speed much faster than the speed of Riemann or not?
Yes, it is. So you can take that as an adiabatic limit, okay, as an approximation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes.
Is the connection between your anti-V and symmetric and non-symmetric?
No. The you can have both type A and type B Goldstone bosons even when coset space is non-symmetric. So symmetric space is not a necessary condition to have these two classifications. No, it doesn't have to be symmetric. For general discussion, I don't really see it. So symmetric space is convenient because you have this asymmetry of inverting the sign of the Goldstone fields, and that can actually make the effective Lagrangian look simpler. But other than that, I don't think there is any fundamental difference between symmetric and non-symmetric spaces. Maybe some other people can chime in on this.
So in your big table, when you have done multiple possibilities, some of those examples are superfluous.
You're talking about this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in that case, you don't have, I'm coming back to my question about boost. You don't have an external medium that breaks boosts for you. That is the medium. So you have to, for this system, you do have to consider this continuous breaking of space and symmetries.
Well, so I certainly did consider spontaneous breaking of Galilean boost.
In that table? Because the analysis you presented of that brought to that table, you were saying it's only going to be.
Yes, but that's because this Galilean boost symmetries don't give you any independent degrees of freedom because of this nodal constraint between the symmetric currents. So I can ignore them in the end and just focus on this U1 part to write the effective Lagrangian.
You have to study this on a case by case basis. So for instance, for region 3, this phase is a non-trivial spontaneous breaking of angular momentum and spin down to the angle of the
loop.
So you do have to consider speed and symmetry. Then, in many cases, you are right. You can neglect the extra goals that you get from there.
Right. So the basic statement I can make is that if you consider this general possibilities of many different systems, at least you definitely do need Goldstone boson degrees of freedom for internal symmetries, and they are classified by type A and type B. There could be additional Goldstone bosons associated with the space-time symmetry breaking, and in most cases they do not. But you can consider such cases as well. Yes. Okay.
Spontaneously broken symmetries are going to be non-linearly realized on the Goldstones.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't have extra Goldstones for those,
right,
they are still there.
So yeah, that's right.
Construction should take into account that. Because that space.
Yeah, so they can give you additional constraints, like in this case of the vortex lattice, because of this space-time nature of the transformation of Goldstones, certain terms are forbidden. But for the purpose of coming up with the parameterization of the coset space, they are not necessary for this purpose because of the redundancy. So we're saying the same thing, but I believe.
Yes.
Yes.
So why do I have to care about the boost if it doesn't commute?
In this case, it does. It's a superfluid, giving in terms of the non-relativistic. Oh, okay, yeah, that's right. But it's actually still conserved, right? So if you have a boost operator, what are you saying that this is proportional to the momentum? But this is still a conserved charge because this actually has this commutator. But in addition, it depends explicitly on time. And this actually cancels the commutator. So this is what typically happens with the space-time symmetries. So even when certain operator doesn't commute with the Hamiltonian, that doesn't mean it's not conserved. It could still be conserved if there's an explicit time dependence. And that's exactly what happens with the boost operator. So nonetheless, it's... I don't think you can make any operator conserved this way, because the operator has to come out from Noether's theorem. So for a given symmetry, you know exactly what the operator is. You can arbitrarily put in explicit time dependence in there by hand. So it really has to be a symmetry of the system. And that guarantees that even though there's non-zero commutator, a charge is still conserved, and therefore it's a symmetry.
So we actually have a time constraint.
Okay. Okay, thank you.